Welcome to The Wrap-Up, a weekly podcast that gives you an insider's look at the top stories in Hollywood. I'm your host, Daniel Goldblatt, assistant managing editor. Sharon Waxman is actually off this week, so joining me is The Wrap's executive editor, Tom Geyer. Thanks for filling in, Tom.
My pleasure to be here with you, Daniel.
I can't wait. This will be a fun adventure for us both.
Absolutely.
This week, we have my interview with two of the people responsible for bringing HBO Max's Hacks to life, director of photography Adam Bricker and costume designer Kathleen Felix-Hager, both of whom were nominated for Emmys this year. We talked about building the look of the show during the pandemic, shooting Vegas in Los Angeles, and I made each of them pick their favorite look from season one. And speaking of Hacks, the Wrap sponsors this week include HBO Max presenting Hacks, nominated for 15 Emmys, including Outstanding Comedy Series and Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for Jean Smart. Really, if you haven't watched it already, I highly recommend it. First, Tom, let's get into some headlines. Rachel Maddow, more like Rachel Maddow, I have to give you all the credit for that amazing pun this week. The MSNBC host signed a new deal with the network that will reportedly pay her $30 million a year. And get this, she'll actually work less. She's transitioning from a daily show to a weekly one, along with some other special programming. Maddow is arguably the face of the network and its top-rated draw, generating $66 million in advertising revenue in 2020. Tom, what do you think? Is Rachel Maddow worth the money?
Well, it's kind of like MSNBC had really no choice in this matter whatsoever. Getting some of Maddow is worth having her go away altogether, or worse yet, going to another network or streamer and seeing all of that success, all of those revenues, all of that kind of name brand recognition go to someone else and steal their thunder. So the good news for MSNBC is they get Rachel Maddow through the 2024 election in some capacity. She's going to continue her nightly show at least through sometime next year. That gives them some runway to kind of figure out what a transition plan is, who might be able to replace her in prime time. And they also get her, basically, and no one else gets her. So that's the big win for them. They're going to get less of her, which is going to be a downside.
Yeah, I think you made the point. She's one of the people that you associate most with MSNBC, maybe most of all, I think. You know, I mean, Brian Williams is there now. He's had a rough few years. She is the focal point. She's the centerpiece. And I think, you know, on the big moments and the big stories, it's like Lester Holt, her, Brian, that's the face of the network for NBC News in general. So yeah, to your point, to see her walk and go somewhere else, she's still so young. She'd have so many more years of a career left in her. You want to keep that relationship going, I think, for as long as they can.
I think that's right. And I think, you know, the big risk for them is it's a lot of money. You know, it's half of what the revenue they made from her last year. It's unclear how they're going to make up that revenue, but the risk to them, you know, as everyone is shifting into streaming, you know, Fox Nation is, you know, Fox News's streaming service that is growing. CNN is launching its own streaming service. It's all about having content franchises. So, you know, Netflix has a franchise on Shonda Rhimes, and for MSNBC, you know, the Rachel Maddow franchise is what they really want to cling to. You don't want to lose any ground in this highly competitive environment.
No, I agree. She, watching her somewhere else would have been disastrous for them.
Yeah, and you can imagine how like an HBO might want to have a Rachel Maddow show that comes, you know, right after Bill Maher, or right after John Oliver. And that would have been a huge win for them. And they probably would have paid a bucket of money for just that opportunity. So keeping her, not losing her, is almost more valuable to them than, you know, losing her, you know, four nights a week.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of Jon Stewart a little bit. I mean, I know he left sort of willingly, but I'm sure the people at Comedy Central have to still be kicking themselves that he's not part of their universe anymore.
Right. The movie industry put its best foot forward this week at CinemaCon, which is the largest gathering of the movie theater industry. Universal took a victory lap over the success of F9 in theaters while touting the next big Jurassic Park movie and the upcoming Halloween films. We also got closer looks at The Batman with Robert Pattinson, The Matrix 4, Dune, Spencer, and countless other new movies. But it's not all sunshine and roses for the movie theater industry, which has only just begun to rebound from an almost year-long shutdown because of the pandemic. And more films seem to be pushing back the release dates or going to streaming or going to a hybrid streaming theatrical release as the COVID pandemic drags on and the Delta variant seems to be creating continuing problems. Is the glass half full or half empty, do you think, for movie theaters going forward in the coming months, Daniel?
I think I'm going to use a Matrix analogy and say that the movie theater industry is going to say there is no glass. They're just kind of ignoring what is going on one side. Like, the past is the past, and even like the near future is one thing. And then they're just still pushing those release dates, not pushing like in moving, pushing like promoting that nothing's going to change. We know that the Bond people are very steadfast in keeping it in theatrical only. Warner Brothers had great success this year, I think, with their sort of strategy. And I think it made HBO Max one of the best platforms around, probably second only or third, maybe with Netflix and Disney. I think it accomplished what they wanted to, but they're pushing for theatrical next year. But family films are still moving. We're seeing Cinderella's went to Amazon. The next Hotel Transylvania movie has been pushed a few times because children can't get vaccinated. So it has an effect on the release. So it just seems like they kind of have tunnel vision. They kind of see what they want to see and they just remain optimistic, which I guess they have no choice but to do. But I just worry that we're really close to, cutting and pasting all the delayed stories that we did 3, 4, 5, 6 months ago and doing them all again. And it's just like, it's so depressing to do every time we get another wave of these movie release dates getting pushed back. It's sad, but I don't know what else they can do.
I think they're, between a rock and a hard place. Absolutely. Because there aren't a lot of options, especially for the big tentpole movies that cost, $200 million to make, almost as much to market. And there's no clear pathway for them to earn that money back in the current environment. There are rare exceptions. F9 just crossed the $700 million global box office mark. That's a very good sign, but that's really an outlier because we're seeing lots of really big films. They're just not earning the profits that you would expect them to make in a normal environment. And the big worry, of course, is that by the time we get to a new normal, audiences will have become so accustomed to seeing big movies on opening day on a streaming service. And so what is the new normal going to look like? And are we going to see only tentpoles going forward in the theaters? Or are we going to see the kind of breadth of movie fare that we've come to expect? And that's the real worry, I think, for the entire industry.
Yeah, I think you can't make the... And also, the thing that we talked about a lot in the beginning of this was, a lot of these tentpole movies are part of franchises, and they have very specific laid out plans. This movie has to go, and then we're going to release that one after because they tell a continued story. So it's these things don't exist in a vacuum. You can't push the next Marvel movie without pushing probably 3 more Marvel movies and 2 Marvel shows at the same time. And eventually all of these movies are going to be competing for a very limited amount of space on the release calendar. So do you take the loss and suck it up and release it when it's supposed to keep your schedule? Or do you just keep pushing everything back years? It's win-win or lose-lose. I don't know which it is, but it doesn't work either way, I don't think. And hopefully we'll get out of this. And they've been resistant to vaccine mandates too, the theaters have, which I would probably turn some people off and encourage others. So maybe they've determined that's a zero-sum game. I don't know. But I know, Tom, I know you went to a Broadway show. When do you see yourself going back to a movie theater?
I've been back in movie theaters, mostly for screenings, mostly for advanced screenings. Everyone is masked. throughout. They're mostly critic screenings that I've been going to. You know, I think we're probably getting to a place where whether it is vaccine passports, I had to bring my vaccine validation card with me to the Broadway theater. They checked it. They checked it against my driver's license to make sure that it was really me. It was actually a surprisingly thorough process and also a surprisingly speedy process. It took no more time than, you know, going through the metal detector and you know, and all of that stuff. So the show started pretty much on time, which also surprised me. But so I think there are ways that we're going to adjust to this new reality. Because I think, you know, we all want to gather back into whether it's going to concerts, whether it's going to theater, whether it's going to the movies again. The question is, you know, how often we're going to be willing to do that when we've become so accustomed to experiencing just about everything we want to see in our living rooms.
Yeah, Sharon always makes fun of me because I talk about releases in 4K because I have a great TV and a good stereo setup. So I love watching stuff at home. This pandemic has been great for me in that regard, getting movies right, HBO Max right away, Disney Plus. I've loved it. It's worked for me perfectly. Finally, this week, the struggles at Time's Up continue. When I say literally right before we started recording this podcast, I could not mean it more. Literally right when we recorded this podcast, Time's Up CEO Tina Chen stepped down from her position. I didn't even have time to write something. That's how quickly this happened. She released a statement saying she was going to step down. And she said, quote, "It is clear that I am not the leader who can accomplish that in this moment," talking about the work that had to be done. "I am especially aware that my position at the helm of Time's Up has become a painful and divisive focal point where those very women and other activists who should be working together to fight for change are instead battling each other in harmful ways." That was just sort of the latest in a string of bad news for the organization. Chen had said earlier this week in an interview with The Skim that she thought the group was, quote, "used as cover by Andrew Cuomo's administration when it came out that she had advised for them." You know, and on top of all of this, the Wrap dug into the group's tax returns this week, which showed, among other things, that the group spent 45% more on staff salaries on 2019 than it did on its legal defense fund, which is kind of the point of the whole thing. And it paid over $500,000 to Lisa Borders, who served less than 2 months that year as the nonprofit CEO. That's a better job than I think even Rachel Maddow got. Tom, I don't even know where to begin with these problems. And I wrote that sentence even before Tina Chen stepped down as CEO. So now I really have no idea where to begin. What strikes you as the most glaring issue for the organization?
Well, I think Time's Up was founded by a bunch of women in Hollywood with very good intentions right in the aftermath of the Harvey Weinstein scandal back in the fall of 2018. They wanted to, you know, galvanize that energy and momentum toward calling out bad actors. And I don't mean just actors, but, you know, bad men. For the most part, it was men who had been doing horrible things in the workplace, sexual harassment, sexual assault. They wanted to provide legal support, PR support, psychological support for the mostly female employees who had experienced these awful things, not just within Hollywood, but with other industries. They raised a bunch of money, supposedly about $24 million by January of 2020. And they, by all appearances, appear to have lost their way. In the last month or so, we've seen that two of their top leaders, including Tina Chen, were advising Andrew Cuomo on how to handle the sexual harassment charges against him. That has all come out. And we dug into their tax forms for their first full year in operation in 2019, which is the most recent data that we have for them. And they raised about $11.5 million in contributions. They spent $4.5 million on salaries and other compensation, and they handed out $3 million in grants to the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. That was the sole, you know, driving force that of their founding, this legal defense fund to provide, you know, victims of workplace harassment legal support. By all accounts, that has done wonders for these victims and survivors. Thousands of women were helped by this. It was run by an independent group, the National Women's Law Center, not by Time's Up itself. But $3 million versus $11 million in contributions is a pretty sizable gap. Tina Chen got a significant salary, as did her predecessor, Lisa Borders, who resigned after just two months into 2019, when her own son was accused of sexual assault. She still walked away with $590,000 for the year. I'm assuming that they had to pay out her contract for the year, even though she left 7 weeks into the year. But this is no way to run a charity that is supposed to be supporting women and female survivors of workplace harassment. It's not good optics. They have also strayed into talking about, Golden Globes and racial equity. They strayed into, issuing statements about Scarlett Johansson and her battle with Disney over salaries. But going to the defense of multimillionaire actresses seems pretty far from, supporting the sort of everyday women who are subjected to harassment and assault by men in the workplace. So hopefully with Tina Chen out of the picture, they can refocus on what they want to be going forward and what their mission is. I think a lot of providers are expecting them to, sort of go back to the basics in terms of what they were founded on.
Yeah, I think you make a good point there. I feel like they were becoming one of those groups where when there was a story about women, you just emailed them and asked for a statement. You had a great story. And that's not what they're there for. And that was what a lot of the survivors were complaining about. And yeah, I think they just lost their way. And hopefully this will get them back on track.
I think that's right. I mean, I think there may be a place for, another organization that can speak to the issues of women in Hollywood and trying to, advance Hollywood specifically in ways that support women and in women's equity. But this group was founded as a Me Too organization. It was founded to kind of speak up for women who do not have a voice in the workplace when their bosses, when their overlords are doing really despicable things. And that's the public association of what Time's Up is. It's very much that. And to kind of stray from that felt like a betrayal to a lot of the women who contributed money and who contribute their resources and time to the early days of the organization.
Yeah, I think it's time for a reset, for sure.
Yeah.
All right, it doesn't feel right to do Wax On, Wax Off without Sharon Waxman. I think we're just going to skip it this week, people. I hope you don't mind. So when we come back, we are going to have my interview with director of photography, Adam Bricker, and costume designer, Kathleen Felix-Hager, both of whom were nominated for Emmys this year for their work on season one of HBO Max's Hacks. Stay tuned. Our guests this week each received an Emmy nomination for their work on season one of hit HBO Max series Hacks, which scored 15 nominations in all. Please welcome to the podcast Adam Bricker, nominated for Outstanding Cinematography for a Single Camera Series Half Hour, and Kathleen Felix-Hager, nominated for Outstanding Contemporary Costumes. Thank you guys for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right, so I want to talk about this show, obviously, which I loved so much, and I would love to start at the very beginning with the first shot of the show. I rewatched the pilot last night, and it's such a great opening to get us into this world, to introduce us to Jean Smart's character, Deborah Vance. Can I ask you both, I'm sure a lot of thought went into that opening for each of you. What did you think about what went into the choices that you made for that opening shot? Kathleen, I'll start with you, and I'm sure you're going to talk about that gold jacket.
Well, I mean, so much of it was actually on the page, which was really interesting to me and exciting. And the fact that we tell this beginning, like we introduce the character, from behind. So you have to sort of say so much wordlessly. So I think that, the choice of doing that one beautiful long shot that Adam did was so amazing. And then we really wanted something that she was wearing that would be sort of instantly iconic and also sort of tell you immediately who she was. So I found that coat. It was actually sort of multicolored ombre. And I remember asking, I think, Adam one time if he was afraid of reflections or sequins, and he said no. So then we just leapt off from there.
So Adam, what about you? What went into that opening one shot?
Yeah, I think like Kathleen said, it was right there on the page. And I was just so excited from the get-go when I read the pilot script and saw that it was opening with this energetic one shot that starts with Jean Smart playing the role of Deborah Vance and her curtain call and sort of traversing through the backstage area and into the bowels of her casino where she has a residency, and then finally into her like lavishly designed dressing room where we first reveal her face in the vanity mirror. And it was a really a fun shot to take on. We stitched together several environments, some on a soundstage, some at a theater, bringing multiple sets together to create this oneer. And one, it's visually stimulating, but two, I think it really, like, from the get-go tells the story of this character. You understand that she's a Vegas icon, and you also see that she has a routine and is sort of practiced. And you know, it's both energetic, but she's also going through the motions a bit. So there's a duality, I think, to the shot. What I really love about it is that you're right on her back, and she's guiding the camera through her nightly ritual, and we're almost struggling to keep up with her. She's moving so quickly. She's in the center of frame, and I think that Kathleen's sort of sequined blazer that she put her in, like, really draws your eye. Like, it catches the light beautifully as she walks through the different environments, and there's these little pops and flares, and you, even though you're looking at the character's back, you absolutely know where to look. And I think wardrobe played a huge role in that.
Yeah, I think I also wanted to ask you guys both, you mentioned how the opening shot was done at a bunch of sound stages. I thought that for me, Jean Smart's the main character, Hannah and Binder's a main character, and Vegas itself is kind of, to me, like the third main character. Yet you guys did not shoot a lot in Vegas. I'm wondering, for both of you, how did you capture the style of that town without being there?
Yeah, I think that we were... Oh, go ahead, Kathleen.
Oh, yeah. I mean, for me, it was just... Vegas is such a melting pot of, like, flash and glitz, and also sort of there's that other element where people just wear t-shirts and flip-flops, you know? So it was sort of giving it a sense of realness. I just tried to be really true to what people look like in Vegas and pay homage to all of those beats.
And I think that when we were looking at references and photos from Las Vegas for inspiration, we were really drawn to movies and images from older Las Vegas, and not necessarily like the modern LED Las Vegas. So more like the twinkly lights in Old Town that are tungsten and warm. And story-wise, I think that worked for us because, you know, the Deborah Vance character, her heyday was several decades ago. So it sort of felt like a time capsule, almost a modern day time capsule.
Yeah, I was just in Vegas a couple of weeks ago, and I think there's no wrong answer for what someone might be wearing when you're walking in the streets of Vegas or walking through a casino. Everything is definitely possible. And I think one of the things about that sort of also applies to the two main characters is that Deborah and Hannah are just on opposite ends of the spectrum, stylistically, age, personality, everything. What went into creating their separate looks and how they played off each other, and how you guys, you know, let us know little things about each of them in how you dressed them, how you shot them differently, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, I think, you know, I'll go for it. They don't, yeah, thank you. They don't actually meet like until the very end of the pilot. So in the beginning of that first episode, we're cutting back and forth between Deborah Vance, who's in that sort of vintage Las Vegas sort of glowy theater, old dressing room, kind of old school, glamorous house. And then we hard cut to Los Angeles, where Ava is in kind of like a, it's Gen Z. It's kind of got like a hipper, kind of more contemporary vibe to the cinematography. There's more handheld that's introduced. When we first meet her, she's at a really low point career-wise. So it's a little frenetic and she's on edge. I wanted to play visually with our color palette and go against the warmer Las Vegas that we introduced Deborah Vance in and lean into sort of like the cooler palette for Ava's character, which was sort of counter to a lot of the images I was finding of Los Angeles, which is typically, you know, warm California sun. And one of the ideas Lucia and I had was to sort of keep Ava, who's at this low point, in shadow. So the light is cooler and more ambient. And then when possible, we would introduce that California sunshine, but always sort of in the deep background of her frame, sort of like the career she wants in Hollywood is out of reach.
And Kathleen, what was it like trying to dress? Her style is very interesting.
I mean, they represent two different time periods in a woman's life, right? So that was what was initially so attractive to me about the story and the script was like, you very rarely see two women written so true. And I wanted to, represent both of them. Especially Hannah, who is actually the trickier character in some ways, to get her correct, you know, to make her sort of authentically a 25-year-old struggling writer from LA, and to make her seem real and grounded. And she's a little bit of, she's a little lost when we meet her. So I tried to reflect that. And then when we first see them meet, you know, Deborah's in her element. She's, at home, she's super comfortable. I purposely dressed her in sort of tones of the set so she would sort of seem like she was really commanding that space. And then when we meet Ava, she's in just, you know, t-shirt and a pair of high-waisted pants and her Doc Martin boots, and she comes from like stomping in and, you know, sort of demanding attention. And so that was sort of how I tried to balance those two characters, you know, just when we first met them.
Random question I had while I was watching the show again last night. Did either of you go to a Cheesecake Factory to research their decor for that line? Or did you just kind of just figure you knew what it was?
I think I could visualize a cheesecake. I didn't need to go.
So we're doing this call on StreamYard, which is a lot like Zoom. We're in three boxes. We're seeing each other. We're talking. And that is how you guys did a lot of this show. I was struck by how much of it was shot during COVID, and that had to have been a completely unique experience for you guys. I mean, I don't know if you had done one before this, but what were some of the challenges trying to do this and trying to get started and set things up and get things in motion when you all weren't together in the same room to do it? Kathleen?
It was daunting for me at the beginning because it was right sort of maybe 6 months into sort of COVID. And it was the first job that I had done. You know, we were all tested. We had masks and shields. It was strange. Like, I think I never saw Adam's face in person. I just saw him like on our Zoom production meetings and things. And then when we would talk in person, we were, you know, mask, shield, 6 feet apart. I was like, I couldn't hear what he was saying. So I think those practical challenges of trying to be safe and respect people's boundaries and work was challenging for everybody. But in a strange sense, it was also, for me personally, super satisfying because it sort of gave me a sense of normalcy in this crazy world that you could sort of still do this creative endeavor. And people are very flexible. I think human beings are like more adaptable than we think. And we all sort of just made it work. And I think it's bonded everyone in a way that was super special because you were making this thing in a very difficult circumstance, but also I feel like everyone really brought their A game to this. I think it was really such a special project and such a special time, and to do something creative in a crazy pandemic world, for me was personally so helpful.
Adam, how about you?
Yeah, I second everything that Kathleen said. I think, you know, it was a wonderful distraction for me, like during a very stressful period in everyone's lives, to have this project that you could sort of sink into and dig deep into. And then, you know, there were the challenges that you would expect. It was, you know, uncomfortable on set to be wearing so much PPE. But at the same time, I think, you know, I was very happy that the studio and all of our collaborators were taking everything so seriously and making sure that everyone was safe and healthy and had the right perspective on that. And then, yeah, I think like not seeing Kathleen's face and everyone's face outside of Zoom, I think that was a challenge. Communication was the biggest obstacle. You know, figuring out the season one of a show with new collaborators. I think you realize like how much like your facial expressions matter when you're communicating and when you're collaborating creatively.
I was joking with you guys when we started that I'd looked you up both on Instagram and Adam, yours in particular is so many like staged shots of things. And for each episode, I think you put through like 7 or 8 different stills that you really liked. If I could ask you both to pick, like for Adam, I guess for you, it would be like one shot. And for Kathleen, maybe for you, it would be one look. Is there something in specific from the season that when you close your eyes and think of it as the first sort of moment that comes to your mind? Adam, I'll ask you first.
Yeah, there's one of my favorite frames, like always actually makes me think of Kathleen. It's when Ava's first watching Deborah Vance perform on stage, and Ava's sort of in the wings watching. And she can see like Deborah Vance from a 3/4 angle, and Deborah Vance is in a sequins blazer that's just like so gorgeous from Kathleen, and the light from the stage kind of reflects on all of these little tiny mirrors and bounces back into the lens, and the lenses that we used had these rainbow flare sort of effects. So not only is it refracting in all these colors, but when it bounces into the lens, you see these little shafts of rainbow coming off of Deborah Vance performing. And it's so magical and great.
Kathleen, how about you?
My favorite shot is there's a, I can't remember what episode, but it's when Jean's character, Deborah Vance, finally gets the pepper shaker that she wants, and she's putting it in her curio cabinet in the kitchen. And there's this shot from the back where you see Jean in this like beautiful sort of teal robe. And it's just like, I took my breath away when I actually saw it in the dailies. I was just so, it just moved me so much. It was so much about, it told so much about who she was in that shot, just her sort of satisfaction about getting that little piece. And then her sort of like, it was so fleeting, you know? And, I just thought it was such a beautiful image of sort of the sad, lonely woman at the end of the day. And I mean, I feel like I want that as like a still. I really do.
Adam, is it on your Instagram somewhere?
Kathleen, I'll send it to you. It's no problem.
Yay.
Done and done. Yeah, no, I remember thinking that when she puts it in, it was all this work and all this effort and all this emotion into like this kind of solitary, somewhat depressing moment where it was just like, boop, puts it on the shelf, walks, and that's the end of it. Like, it wasn't this grand victory that she gets to really enjoy. It just felt like another checkbox for her. Yeah, so I remember that shot well as well. I wanted to get you out of here on a question I thought of last night as I was rewatching the show a little bit, that I'm curious how this affects you. And I get a little tech nerdy sometimes. Sharon makes fun of me when I start talking about like 4K and HDR and all these different things. But I watched the first episode yesterday while I was still at work. Don't tell anyone. On my phone. I just popped it up over here, watched the first one, went home. I watched the second one at home on a brand new LG C1 OLED 4K TV. Gorgeous. So here I am consuming the exact same thing on a screen like the size of my hand, and then a screen that is meant to be viewed by the lights off and perfect and gorgeous, and I can see every little tiny detail. How does the reality of technology and this just vast amount of options we have to consume these products affect the way you guys approach your jobs? Kathleen, I'll ask you first.
I personally don't think in a technical way like that. I really try to gear my creative processes more like what serves the story. So that's how I approach it. But that being said, I've watched the show both ways on my iPad and on a big television screen. And I just feel like the bigger, the better for this, because it is so beautiful. I mean, I got inklings of it when I, like I said before, when I was watching the dailies and I would just be sort of dumbstruck by what I was seeing. And I just think Adam did such a beautiful job painting this picture. Like, it's so lush and rich, and John Carlos's sets and hopefully my costumes. Like, I think they just melded in a way that made such a beautiful picture. And I'm incredibly, incredibly proud of the work that was done on everyone's behalf. I just think the show is stunningly beautiful.
I agree. Adam, how about you?
Yeah, I try. I mean, you know, you can't really control the medium that people watch it in. I know, like, one of my little sisters watched it on her phone, and I was taken aback by that. And then I watched an episode at my parents' house and was like, oh my goodness, these TV settings, these are completely off. But it's out of your control. Yeah, absolutely. I didn't go full on, but I did turn off the motion smoothing. I think, I try not to think about it. And like Kathleen said, you try to be grounded in story and control what you can control. Because of the pandemic, I color corrected the series remotely. And so I was viewing cuts on an iPad, sort of in like a dark closet to make sure that I was in the right viewing environment. But at first I was like, oh, how is this going to work? And then, you know, I thought about it and I talked with the colorist more, and you know, this, we talked about how a lot of people are going to view the show. Most people are going to view the show on a device, or, and, you know, maybe this is a positive thing.
I just found the dichotomy of it so interesting. And, you know, in one sense, I felt like I was not able to appreciate everything on my phone. But then when I watch it on my TV, I'm like, man, am I seeing things that 4 years ago you didn't have to worry about me noticing? You know what I mean? Like, things are so crisp and so clear that I can catch every little thing. It just seems like it feels like it's got to be a little scarier for you guys. Like, we can see everything now. I have to imagine makeup artists too are kind of freaking out by how crystal clear everything is. It's incredible when you watch it on like a great big TV that is calibrated. Adam, I should have you come over and calibrate mine.
Yeah. Well, we didn't want it to feel like so ultra crisp. So even though we shot the show in 8K and anticipated a 4K release, but we used old vintage lenses to sort of give it like a little bit of smush to it, and tried our best to lean into tools like that to give it more of a vintage throwback Deborah Vance feel.
Yeah, and I think that came through. It the show looks, like you said, it felt fantastic all the way through. And I know I said it earlier, but the fact that you guys didn't shoot this in Vegas just blows my mind and shows how much you guys were able to recreate that so perfectly on every level. Kathleen, Adam, thank you so much for joining us. I wish you the best of luck on Emmy night.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming on. And that's it for this week's episode of The Wrap Up. Thank you to all of our listeners. And remember to please follow or subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to rate and review us and let us know what you think of the pod. See you next week.